Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take your source material, could be articles, notes, research, and really get into it.
Yeah, we cut through the noise, pull out the essentials, so you end up not just knowing what it says, but why it actually matters.
We're sort of your guides, helping you get informed fast.
Exactly.
And today, we are diving deep into, well, the very language of science itself.
Hopefully.
You sent over a whole bunch of sources covering fundamental terms.
Mm-hmm. It's like a starter pack for scientific vocabulary, covering everything from, you know, tiny atoms to massive planetary stuff.
So our mission here is to unpack these core concepts, these building blocks, understand them, see how they fit together.
It's really about giving you that vocabulary, that base, so you can tackle a whole range of scientific topics and feel, well, confident about it.
Because let's be honest, you bump into unfamiliar terms all the time, right?
Yeah.
Reading an article, maybe prepping for something work-related.
Yeah, it can stop you in your tracks.
Exactly. So getting these fundamentals down, it's like having the key to unlock a lot more understanding.
It really is. This is the language spoken across so many fields. Chemistry, physics, biology, geology. It connects them.
Okay, then. Let's get into the stack of sources. Where should we start? Maybe with how scientists actually structure their investigations, the language of data and measurement.
Good place to start. Okay. Yeah. So any scientific study, really, it involves dealing with variables.
Variables. Okay, so things that can change.
Pretty much. Factors that can change or vary within the experiment or the system you're looking at.
Right. And the sources mention a few specific kinds.
Mm-hmm. First up, the independent variable. Now, this is the one the scientist is actively changing or controlling. It's like the input, the thing you're testing the effect of.
Okay, so if I'm testing, say, fertilizer on plants, the amount of fertilizer I choose to give each plant, that's independent.
Precisely. You're setting that level.
Yeah.
And then what you measure to see the result of that change, that's the dependent variable.
The outcome.
The outcome, the effect. Yeah. So in your example, it'd be the plant's height, maybe, or its weight. How much it grows depends on the fertilizer.
Dependent. Depends on the independent. Makes sense.
Yeah. But critically, to make sure it only depends on that independent variable, you need to keep other things the same.
The controls.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Your constants, sometimes called controlled variables, same pot size, same soil type, same amount of water, sunlight.
Got it. So you know it was the fertilizer, not something else that caused the difference.
That's the goal. It makes the link between cause and effect much clearer. Reliable results.
Okay, that basic logic is clear. Design the experiment carefully. Then you collect your data. You measure that dependent variable. But raw numbers can be a bit much.
Oh, definitely. That's where visualization comes in. Graphs are key for spotting patterns. Your sources mention a few common ones.
Like a bar graph. That seems good for comparing separate groups.
Yeah, perfect for that. Comparing the average height for plants getting different fertilizer amounts, like you said, discrete categories.
Okay. And a line graph.
That's more for showing change over time or across some continuous range, like tracking one plant's height week by week.
Seeing the trend.
Exactly. Seeing the trend. Now, a scatter plot is a bit different.
How so?
It plots individual data points based on two variables. You put one variable on one axis, the other on the second axis, and see if the dots form some kind of pattern, a potential relationship. A correlation.
So for each plant, I'd plot its fertilizer amount against its final height. See if taller plants generally got more fertilizer.
You got it. Scatter plots are great for hinting at relationships, but remember the old saying, correlation doesn't automatically mean causation.
Right. Important point. Okay, so we know what to measure and control and how to show the data,
huh?
But what about the quality of the measurement itself? The sources talk about precision versus accuracy.
Ah, yes. These get mixed up a lot, but they're distinct. Accuracy is all about how close your measurement is to the actual true value.
Like hitting the bullseye on a target.
Perfect analogy. Precision, though, that's about how close your repeated measurements are to each other. Consistency.
So if I throw darts and they all land really close together, but over in the corner, not near the bullseye, that's precise. But not accurate.
Exactly. Very precise grouping, but way off the true mark. In science, you ideally want both, right? But sometimes you focus on getting precision first, making sure your method gives consistent results, then you work on calibrating it for accuracy.
Okay, that clarifies things. Precision is repeatability. Accuracy is closeness to truth.
Mm-hmm. And to make sure scientists everywhere can understand each other's measurements, they need a common system.
The metric system.
The metric system, yes. The System International, or SI, it's based on powers of 10, which makes conversions so much easier than older systems.
The sources listed the main metric base units.
Yep, the fundamentals. You've got the meter M for length, kilogram kilo-G for mass, second S for time.
Ampere A for current, Kelvin K for temperature.
Mole for amount of substance, and the candela CD for light intensity. Those are the anchors.
And the prefixes scale them up or down. Kilo, centi, milli.
Exactly. It's beautifully logical. Pilo means 1,000. Hecto, 100. Deca, 10. Then going smaller, deci is 1/10. Centi, 1/100. Milli, 1/1000.
So a kilometer is 1,000 meters, a millimeter is 1/1000 of a meter. Huge difference. Clear system.
Right. So variables, graphs, accuracy, precision, metric system. That's really the basic toolkit, isn't it? How science quantifies and communicates findings?
The grammar of evidence, you could say.
I like that. The grammar of evidence.
Okay, let's shift perspective now. From the careful work on a lab bench to, well, the whole planet moving under our feet. The sources get into tectonic boundaries.
Ah, yeah. Big stuff. These are the zones where the Earth's huge, rigid plates, the crust, and the top bit of the mantle meet and interact. Imagine the Earth's surface like a cracked eggshell. These are the cracks.
And how the plates move these cracks defines the boundary type.
That's right. You have convergent boundaries where plates are moving towards each other, crashing together, basically.
Intense and divergent.
They're moving apart, pulling away from each other. This often allows magma to rise up and create new crusts.
And the third type? Transform boundaries.
That's where they slide sideways, grinding past each other horizontally. Builds up a lot of stress.
And these different movements create specific features we can see, right?
Absolutely. At convergent boundaries, if one plate slides under the other, usually denser oceanic crust going under continental or younger oceanic crust, that's a subduction zone.
That sounds like where mountains or volcanoes might form.
Often, yes. Deep ocean trenches form there too. Think the Andes or the Mariana Trench. Where plates diverge underwater, you get ocean ridges. Massive mountain ranges beneath the sea, like the Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
And if they diverge on land?
That creates a rift valley, a big sunken area where the crust is stretching thin. The East African Rift is a prime example.
And transform boundaries, the sliding ones, like the San Andreas.
Exactly. That's a massive fault line, which is just a fracture where blocks of crust have moved. Transform boundaries are essentially huge fault systems.
Wow. So understanding these boundaries is fundamental to figuring out earthquakes, volcanoes, mountain building.
Yeah.
It all connects back to these plate movements.
It really does. These slow, inexorable trends of plate motion shape everything over geological time. It's about their relative motion, how they move compared to each other.
Okay, from the massive scale of planets down to the utterly tiny, let's zoom in. Chemistry basics, starting with the atom.
The atom, the fundamental unit of an element. Everything you see, touch, interact with, it's all made of atoms. They're the basic building blocks.
But they're not just tiny solid balls, right? They have parts.
Correct. There's a dense center, the nucleus. Inside that, you find positively charged protons and neutral particles, neutrons.
And orbiting around that
are the electrons. Tiny, negatively charged particles whizzing around in specific regions called energy levels or shells.
Okay. And an element is just a substance made of only one type of atom.
That's it. Like, pure gold is only gold atoms. Pure oxygen, only oxygen atoms. You can't break an element down into simpler substances by chemical means. The periodic table lists all the known elements.
How do we tell one element from another? What makes gold, gold, and oxygen, oxygen?
The number of protons. That's the key identifier, the atomic number. Okay. Every carbon atom has 6 protons. Every oxygen atom has 8. Change that number, you change the element entirely.
Okay. What about the mass number then?
That's related. Mass number is the total number of protons plus neutrons in the nucleus of a specific atom.
So it can vary slightly.
Yes, for the same element. The proton number is fixed, but the neutron number can differ. These variations are called isotopes, like carbon 12, 6 protons, 6 neutrons, and carbon 14, 6 protons, 8 neutrons are both carbon isotopes.
Gotcha. The sources also made a big deal about the electrons at the very outside.
Ah, the valence electrons. Hugely important. These are the electrons in the outermost energy level, or shell. They're the ones involved when atoms connect with other atoms to form chemical bonds.
So they determine how an atom behaves chemically.
Largely, yes. An atom's tendency to gain, lose, or share electrons is driven by its valence electrons.
And there's a simple way to draw them.
Yeah, an electron dot diagram or Lewis structure. You just write the element symbol and put dots around it to represent the valence electrons. It's a quick visual shorthand for bonding potential.
And based on these electron arrangements, elements get grouped.
Right. broadly into metals, nonmetals, and metalloids. Metals tend to lose electrons. They're usually shiny, conduct heat and electricity. Well, malleable, ductile.
Malleable.
Yeah.
Could be hammered flat, ductile, drawn into wires.
Yep. Nonmetals tend to gain or share electrons, are often poor conductors, maybe gases or brittle solids. And metalloids are in between, exhibiting some properties of both. Think silicon, a semiconductor.
So atom, nucleus, proton, electron, element, atomic number, valence electrons. Understanding these is just foundational for all of chemistry, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's the starting point for understanding matter itself.
Okay, quick practical detour. The source has touched on some hands-on lab skills terms, things you'd actually encounter doing science.
Yeah, useful stuff. Like when you measure liquid in a glass cylinder, the surface isn't usually flat, right? It curves.
Oh, yeah, the meniscus.
That's it. And for water, you read the volume at the bottom of that curve because water molecules stick to the glass a bit. That's adhesion. We might get to that later.
Accuracy again. Reading it right.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Another one, especially with microscopes, is field of view, or FOV.
What you can actually see.
Pretty much. The whole circular area visible through the eyepiece at whatever magnification you're using. Zoom in more, your field of view gets smaller, showing less area, but in more detail.
And for measuring things in that tiny view.
You'll often use the unit micrometer, symbol NM. It's tiny, 1/1000000th of a meter. Standard for cells, bacteria, stuff like that. A human hair is maybe 50 to 100 micrometers across.
Wow. Okay. It's just a basic geometry term, diameter.
Yeah. Simple but useful. The straight line distance across the center of a circle. Good for measuring round things like cells or even figuring out the actual size of your microscope's field of view.
So these terms just highlight that science isn't only ideas. It's also about careful observation and measurement in practice.
It's where theory meets reality.
Yeah. All right. Let's zoom back out again. Big picture.
How
essential stuff moves around our planet. The biogeochemical cycles.
Earth's recycling systems. These describe how vital elements, carbon, phosphorus, nitrogen, move between the air, land, water, and living things.
The carbon cycle seems like a big one.
Huge. It tracks carbon, mostly as co-eros, moving through the atmosphere, dissolving in oceans, being taken up by plants for photosynthesis.
Then animals eat plants, everyone breathes out co-ero.
Things decompose, releasing carbon. Plus, we burn fossil fuels, releasing carbon that was stored away for millions of years. It's complex.
And the phosphorus cycle.
Phosphorus is crucial DNA, energy molecules, but it doesn't really have a gas form like carbon or nitrogen. It mainly cycles through rocks, soil, water, and organisms. Weathering rocks releases it slowly, so it's often a limiting factor for growth in ecosystems.
Slower cycle.
Okay.
Than the nitrogen cycle.
Nitrogen gas is most of our air, like 78%, but plants and animals can't use it directly in that form.
Right. It needs to be fixed.
Exactly. The nitrogen cycle involves special bacteria converting nitrogen gas into usable forms like ammonia and nitrates in the soil. Plants absorb those. Animals eat plants. It's essential for proteins, DNA.
And these cycles are powered by life processes.
Absolutely. Think photosynthesis. Plants pulling co-ero out of the air using sunlight. That drives a huge part of the carbon cycle.
And cellular respiration, when organisms break down food for energy.
That releases co-ero back. So life isn't just affected by these cycles, it actively drives them.
The sources also mention problems when these cycles get messed up.
Yeah, imbalances, often human-caused, like eutrophication.
That sounds bad.
It is. It's when too many nutrients, especially nitrogen and phosphorus, often from farm runoff or sewage, get into water bodies.
Leading to algae blooms.
Massive ones, yeah. They grow like crazy, but then they die, and the bacteria decomposing them use up all the dissolved oxygen in the water. That creates hypoxia, low oxygen.
And really bad hypoxia leads to?
A dead zone. An area where the oxygen is so low, most fish and other aquatic life just can't survive. We see these in places like the Gulf of Mexico. It's a direct result of knocking those nutrient cycles out of whack.
So understanding these cycles is critical for tackling environmental issues. Water quality, even climate change, relates back to the carbon cycle.
Totally interconnected Earth systems thinking.
Let's focus on one substance now, one that's involved in almost everything. Water. It has some really weird, unique properties.
It really does. And those properties make life as we know it possible. They come from its molecular structure, how HUO molecules interact.
Like its high heat capacity.
Yeah, that's a big one. Water can absorb a lot of heat energy without its own temperature shooting up drastically.
Which is why coastal places have milder weather.
Exactly. Oceans act like giant temperature regulators for the whole planet because of this. Absorbing heat, releasing it slowly.
And water molecules stick to each other really well.
That's cohesion. The attraction between water molecules themselves due to hydrogen bonds, which we'll maybe touch on, this cohesion causes surface tension.
Like a skin on the water. Why water forms drops.
Precisely. Or why some insects can walk on water. The molecules hold together tightly at the surface.
And it sticks to other things too.
That's adhesion. Water molecules being attracted to different kinds of molecules. Think water sticking to glass. The combo of cohesion and adhesion allows capillary action water climbing up thin tubes.
How water gets up tall trees.
That's the mechanism. And finally, it's an amazing solvent.
The universal solvent, they sometimes call it.
Yeah, maybe a slight exaggeration, but it dissolves so many different substances. Salts, sugars, gases, many proteins. This is essential for life, transporting nutrients, removing waste. Chemical reactions happen in water.
These properties aren't just trivia. They're why water is essential for life and shapes our planet.
Fundamentally, yes.
Okay, let's go back to the atoms. How do they actually join up? Chemical bonds.
Right. A chemical bond is just the force holding atoms together to make molecules or larger structures. It's how we get compounds, not just individual elements floating around.
And there are different main types.
Mm-hmm. One is the ionic bond. This typically happens between a metal and a nonmetal. One atom, the metal, essentially gives one or more electrons to the other atom, the nonmetal.
Creating charged atoms, ions.
Exactly. A positive ion that lost electrons and a negative ion that gained them. The ionic bond is the strong electrical attraction between those opposite charges. Table salt, sodium chloride, NaCl is the classic example.
Okay, transfer of electrons. What's the other main type? Covalent bond.
Covalent. Here, atoms share electrons. They don't fully transfer them. Instead, two atoms both hold onto the same pair or pairs of electrons. This sharing holds the atoms together.
And they can share more than one pair.
Yep. A single bond is one shared pair. A double bond is two shared pairs. A triple bond is three shared pairs. Generally, more pairs means a stronger, shorter bond.
Now, within covalent bonds, polar versus nonpolar. That sounds important.
Very important. It's about how equally those electrons are shared. In a nonpolar covalent bond, the sharing is pretty much equal. The electrons aren't pulled more strongly to one atom than the other. Think of the bond between two identical atoms, like in an O or O's molecule.
Balanced, but polar covalent.
The sharing is unequal. One atom pulls the shared electrons more strongly towards itself. This happens when the two atoms have different electron attracting power.
Okay.
So the atom that pulls harder gets a slight negative charge, and the other atom gets a slight positive charge. You get a separation of charge across the bond, creating a dipole, like a tiny plus end and minus end.
And what determines that pulling power?
A property called electronegativity. It's basically a measure of how much an atom wants to grab electrons in a bond. If there's a big difference in electronegativity between two bonded atoms, the bond will be polar. Oxygen is much more electronegative than hydrogen.
Ah, so the OH bonds in water are polar.
Exactly, which makes the whole water molecule polar. That's key to many of its properties we just discussed.
And there was one other type of bond mentioned, a weaker one.
The hydrogen bond. Yeah, this isn't a bond inside a molecule holding atoms together like ionic or covalent. It's a weaker attraction between different molecules.
Okay, how does it work?
It happens when you have a hydrogen atom that's already covalently bonded to a very electronegative atom, like oxygen, nitrogen, or fluorine, in one molecule. That hydrogen becomes slightly positive. It's then attracted to a slightly negative atom, like O, N, or F, on a nearby molecule.
So it's like an intermolecular sticky spot.
Good way to put it. They're weak individually, but when you have lots of them, like between water molecules, they add up to have significant effects influencing boiling points, cohesion, surface tension.
So understanding bonds explains why stuff is the way it is, why diamond is hard, why salt dissolves, why water is liquid.
Absolutely. The type and strength of bonding dictates a substance's macroscopic properties.
Okay, one last major area from the sources, the atmosphere. That gaseous blanket around Earth, and the difference between climate and weather.
Crucial distinction. People use them interchangeably, but scientifically. Weather is short term. What's happening now or in the next few days in a specific place? Sunshine, rain, wind, temperature today.
And climate?
Climate is the long-term picture. The average weather patterns over decades, centuries for a region. What's the typical rainfall in Seattle in November? What's the average temperature range in Arizona in summer? It's the overall pattern, not the day-to-day fluctuations.
Climate is what you expect, weather is what you get.
Something like that, yeah. And the atmosphere where this happens isn't just one uniform blob. It has layers.
Right. Starting from the ground up.
We live in the troposphere. It goes up maybe 7 to 15 kilometers. This is where basically all weather happens. Clouds, rain, wind systems. Temperature generally drops as you go higher.
Above that.
Stratosphere. Up to about 50 kilometers. Key feature here is the ozone layer, which absorbs harmful UV radiation from the sun. Interestingly, temperature increases with height here because of that absorption.
Okay, then the mesosphere.
Up to about 85 kilometers. Gets very cold again. This is where most meteors burn up shooting stars.
And the outermost layer.
The thermosphere extends hundreds of kilometers. The air is incredibly thin, but the few molecules there absorb high energy solar radiation, so the temperature is technically very high, even though it wouldn't feel hot. The space station orbits here.
Wow. Okay. The sources also define some key atmospheric effects we hear about all the time.
Like the greenhouse effect. This is actually natural and essential. Certain gases in the atmosphere, water vapor, co-uromethane, trap some of the heat radiated from Earth's surface, keeping the planet warm enough for life.
Right.
Without it, Earth would be frozen.
But then there's global warming.
Right. That refers specifically to the observed increase in Earth's average global temperature over recent decades and centuries. It's largely attributed to the increased concentration of those greenhouse gases due to human activities, especially burning fossil fuels. It's like thickening the greenhouse blanket.
An enhancement of the natural effect.
Exactly. And climate change is the even broader term. Climate change includes global warming, the temperature rise, but also encompasses all the other long-term shifts in climate patterns. Changes in precipitation, more extreme weather events, shifting seasons, melting glaciers. Global warming is a primary driver of current climate change.
Got it. So these terms, climate, weather, atmospheric layers, greenhouse effect, global warming, climate change, they give us the language to talk about the air around us and the long-term trends affecting our planet.
Absolutely. Essential vocabulary for understanding our environment and the changes it's undergoing.
Well, we have certainly covered a lot of ground today. Thanks for helping unpack this really useful set of core terms. We went from the incredibly small atoms, bonds.
Mm-hmm. All the way up to planet scale processes like plate tectonics and the structure of the atmosphere.
And looked at vital cycles, the unique nature of water, and the very tools scientists use to measure and analyze the world.
And the key thing is, these aren't just isolated dictionary entries, are they? They're interconnected concepts. Understanding variables helps you understand experiments about cycles. Understanding bonds helps you understand water's properties.
They really are the building blocks. Every complex scientific idea or discovery rests on foundations like these. Getting a handle on them is, like we said, a shortcut to deeper understanding.
It gives you the framework, the mental scaffolding to make sense of so much more.
So as we wrap up, maybe something for you, the listener, to think about. Pick almost anything you see happening around you. Water boiling, a tree growing, maybe even just breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Try to think about how many of these fundamental concepts we discussed are involved all at once. Heat capacity, chemical bonds, photosynthesis, gas exchange, cellular respiration, maybe even measurement units if you think about temperature.
It's all interwoven, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
These terms describe the fundamental workings of the world. Once you start seeing them in action everywhere, things really start to click into place.
Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.